Hi there. Welcome to the Digital Insurance Pint podcast. I'm your host, Tom Reed. And as always, I'm joined by Adam Mitchell, CEO of Mitchell & Whale, Jeff Roy, CEO of Excalibur, Steve Earle, CEO of Cheap Insurance. And our special guest today is Ben Ritchies from Aviva, Executive VP and Managing Director of Strategic Partnerships. Can you just tell us what that actually means?
Within Aviva, I sit on the exec committee and I look after the strategic partnerships we have as a business. We have a big relationship with RBC. We have some smaller partnerships with other people across Canada, like Save On Foods in Western Canada and Tesla and a few other small partnerships. And I'm involved in occasional strategic partnerships with brokers as we look at those.
Just to make sure we don't have any conflict of interest, do you have any strategic partnerships with the guys on the panel here?
Not at the moment.
Right.
I should have saved that for later.
Yeah. Maybe, second order of business. Can we explain the duster? Can we go into the?
Yeah. What's with the facial covering there?
Well, it is November, otherwise known as Movember, and so I'm trying to raise awareness and funds for men's health. So.
Okay. Awesome. And maybe just for our guests who may not know you, can you explain your accent?
Yeah. So, I'm a Brit, Tom.
What? No.
Speak the Queen's English, and I've been in Canada for 5 years, so I'm still a relative trainee Canadian compared to you guys.
We do have some speed round questions, which will test your knowledge of some parts of Canadiana here. So, give us your favorite Canadian band of all time.
When I was about kind of 18, 19, I've got a lot of good memories of rocking out to Alanis Morissette stuff, so I probably would say her stuff would be my favorite. There's a bunch of Canadiana that I kind of got introduced to since I got here that I haven't quite got my head around yet. So things like the Tragically Hip, I haven't quite fallen in love with yet. But you know,
interview's over.
Okay, yeah, that's it. We're done. So you got a package from us. Which of the beers did you open?
Well, I'm about to open, actually. I've got Pucker Up.
Pucker Up.
Pucker Up, nice.
I hear you. I'm having a Pucker Up tonight, too.
Oh, yeah.
Right on. Yeah. Good on. So, is Pucker Up from Garrison's as well?
Absolutely.
All right.
I ran out of Garrison, my pack. Steve, you haven't shipped me some more, but I have some Stonehouse Brewing Czech Pilsner from my local brewery here, from Mike Corey.
So, Jeff, you're saying that Garrison's was so good, you finished it all?
Well, we did three episodes, and Steve only sent me three beers. So,
I got four. Sucks to be you.
There you go.
I got six, I think.
I got four, and I'm only doing one episode. So,
there you go. Right?
You have to drink them all in the episode, though, just so you know. Okay. Favorite and or least favorite part of the industry.
My favorite part is always going to be about how we help people in their time of need, being able to be there for people. There's not a lot more life affirming than being involved in one of those difficult claims and seeing that through. And then I think the probably least favorite is just the general sense of complexity that still exists in our products for customers, right? Just as an industry, I think we can do a better job of trying to simplify, you know, what our offerings are for consumers to make it a bit easier to understand.
All right. So what was your biggest surprise upon coming to Canada 5 years ago?
Personally, it was probably just how cold Canada can really be. I remember coming in February to Toronto when it was like minus 25 or something. But I think professionally, I'd probably say I came to Canada with an expectation that the market was going to really flip and all the transition to digital was going to accelerate really aggressively. And it hasn't really played out the way I was expecting it to. It's a bit more nuanced and a bit more complex landscape to get your head around.
Name one of the seven dwarfs.
Happy.
Happy. If you were given an all-expenses-paid trip to Sarnia, would you take it?
I had to look up where Sarnia was. I've got to be honest. But I would. I mean, I think you may remember, Tom, from when we worked together, I was always a keener to volunteer to go anywhere that we needed to send someone from the exec committee. So I remember volunteering for Winnipeg in February. So yes, I would definitely take an all expenses paid trip.
Awesome. How many Netflix series have you watched since COVID hit and locked us down?
Well, I've been watching two, actually. There's a couple that I've found really kind of interesting. But one of them is I don't know if you guys have ever seen Jack Whitehall's Travels with My Father. He's a British stand-up comedian who's about 30, and his dad's like in his late 70s. And it's like a sort of every week they go on a road trip somewhere together, and his dad hates every second of it. It's just every second of it. He cannot stand it. And it's just hilarious watching this stand-up comedian wind his father up, and you can tell he just finds the whole thing so funny.
Wait, so let's turn our attention here to some more professional kind of questions here. Aviva has a new global CEO, Morris Tulloch, who we all know and love, has stepped down, and Amanda is now the global CEO. What impact do you foresee on Aviva Canada and its broker partners of the new CEO?
Well, I mean, I haven't had a chance to spend that much time with her. We've had a meeting with her as the Exec Committee of Canada, and we've obviously seen her talk a lot about the business internally and give us her views on strategy and direction for the company. I think she's really impressive. I think she's got incredible focus around what she's trying to achieve. She's got a real passion to transform the business. And I think she's been very clear about where her target markets are that she wants to strengthen and grow and invest in the UK, Ireland and Canada. So for the Canadian business, that can only be a good thing. I think when Aviva as a big global organization chooses to throw its weight behind a market like Canada, we've got a real opportunity to progress and develop as an organization that can really, you know, go about doing some more great things with some real pace and vigor. So I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's got the potential to help us both grow and transform as a business.
Okay. Ben, 4 years ago, last week, we had the Aviva Hackathon, which you're very big, one of your big initiatives. Yeah. Digital Garage was an incredible space. I was lucky enough to participate in it. What did you learn from the Digital Garage and the experience? What did you learn, and what were your biggest disappointments?
You know, when we set up our garage here in Canada, it was really focused around engineering, right? As Aviva Canada, we wanted to build a digital engineering function so that we could digitize our systems and build out some propositions for customers, APIs. And you know, through the hackathon, as you know, we built something that then turned into Aviva Ally. So I think we achieved what we wanted to in terms of building some capability to build some new technology that could, you know, help us advance the business. So I think as things evolved, the UK garage became much more about innovation, venturing, working with startups, customer propositions, some of that kind of stuff. I think it's now pulled back a little bit back towards the core of, you know, building digital technology for the business. But I think, you know, we achieved a lot in terms of getting the foundations in place to be able to digitize the business and start that journey and move that forward. I think it, you know, in my mind, timing is sometimes everything. And there was a point where we probably had, you know, headwinds as an industry heading towards us at a time when we weren't necessarily expecting them. So heading into what was, you know, quite a difficult period, I think, for Ontario Auto meant that we didn't have quite the same freedom to invest in innovation and develop new propositions. But look, I think we're coming out of that period. We've obviously got the headwinds of COVID, but I feel like, you know, certainly Aviva is a much stronger business than it was at that point. And we've got, you know, more opportunity with potentially more support from our parent group. I think, you know, the garage is still there. It's there's no one in it, and it hasn't been for 8 months, just like every other office in Canada. But I'm sure at some point soon we'll get back to work and in the office, and we'll continue to develop the projects that the garage originally had at its core as its aspiration.
Yeah, I think the garage for us, first of all, the garage brought a lot of us here on this call together, and it did some great work early on to, you know, light a fire to help brokers get over humps. And I think it was, phenomenal. And I really enjoyed the hackathon. It was cool. I mean, the people I met and going through the process and, you know, coming out with, we called it a catalyst, but we had a quote, bind, and issue solution we built in 24 hours that turned into Ally. So that was really cool. So thanks for doing that.
Ben, from an early time as a broker, I was taught that really the only thing consistent about Aviva was inconsistency. So what are we going to see that changes with this new global CEO? What's going to change to make our lives easier as brokers?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I think locally in Canada, we're doing quite a lot in that space to try and invest in our, you know, our foundations, our underlying systems, infrastructure, APIs, Guidewires. You know, there's a lot going on that I think will help with that. I think, you know, what having a new CEO brings to that group level is focus and support. You know, if we're going to be one of three target markets, then the expectation I think would be that we get a lot more interest and support from the group around the things that we want to progress. And I think obviously trying to support the broker channel to develop and grow and you know, support them with technology to do that will be a key part of that.
So you talked about having the headwinds you head into and market timing and, you know, good and bad luck on it. Is there anything you do differently, or do you play all the cards the same way second hand around?
No, I think it is different. I mean, I think, you know, COVID as an event is in some ways the kind of accelerator that digitization has probably been looking for in Canada. Now, it's obviously an awful event, and I don't really want to talk about there being anything quote unquote positive to come out of it. But, you know, when I look at digitization and the kind of acceleration of digitization of the business in the UK, you see these kind of moments in time where something happens that changes things. You know, we had the 2008 financial crisis in the UK, and it's no coincidence in my mind that the aggregators and price comparison websites really started to emerge in 2009, 2010, and suddenly became enormous overnight. It's, in my mind, it's no coincidence that that kind of economic strain bred creativity. So in my mind, I feel like, you know, Canada it's had relative prosperity for a really prolonged period of time. COVID is an event that I think has the potential to really disrupt. So I think, you know, your playbook will be slightly different, because I think we're going to see things potentially move slightly quicker than we might otherwise have done.
I've been working with Aviva and a number of other carriers trying to push the DX football down the field, so to speak. Is that something that Aviva sees as a partner to your digital efforts? Like, how does DX fit into Aviva's various investments?
Well, I mean, I think the key thing in my mind is about how we support data exchange, programs, standardization standards programs across the industry to enable us to accelerate the progress of digital kind of as a sector, right? I think in my mind, you know, we can all as carriers individually go and progress our own point solutions, but you only move the whole industry forwards if you work together on things like this. So in my mind, it's something that we certainly talk about as being important, and I think our commitment to that is pretty clear. We want to invest in, you know, more connectivity, more kind of standardized ways to interoperate and work with brokers more effectively.
We're very much behind, many years behind the UK from an API, digital enablement, connectivity. What can a broker watching in on this expect to see if you could wave a magic wand and give all of the industry over here some connectivity?
Yeah, I mean, a long time ago, when I was a kind of software engineer, I was involved in some stuff in the UK that was run by a standards body called Polaris, which was building out kind of messaging data interchange standards for commercial insurance. And they had a portal called iMarket where you brought, you know, everybody could hook into that, connect and, you know, show what they had. And I think, you know, the standards work that was driven through that just drove everybody in the industry towards a position where they were, you know, working on the same underlying standards that meant people could start to build propositions on top of things a bit easier. If you then look at the 2008-2009 kind of period where aggregators started, you know, although some of the aggregators then and still now, patched together all kinds of different data standards from different different companies, I think the more consistency there is in the way in which they do that, the more innovation that can be built on top of it. So in my mind, I think if we can get to a point where we've got some really clear standards in place and some universally accepted patterns in terms of how you interact with carriers, then you'll see more innovation built on top of that. It costs, you know, ultimately the more different models and message formats and data standards you guys have to deal with, the more money you're investing in that rather than innovating on customer experience or some of the more interesting elements of the.
Like if I'm a small broker in Sarnia named Barry Hogan, and what, how is my day going to change, you know, when I'm doing something because these standards have been enacted?
Well, I think there'll be you know, more platforms available for you to hook into, connect to, white label. I think you'll just have more options in terms of the way in which you can run your business.
What do you think the broker of the future needs to do to compete against a direct better? Is API and connectivity enough? What's some insight of what brokers could do to better adapt in the next 1 to 2 years to make sure we stay relevant?
You need to be really clear on what your value proposition is to the customer and how you digitize that. You know, there are some unique features of being a broker that give you an advantage over the directs, and it's about how you build on those, leverage those, and in some cases digitize that experience in a way that perhaps hasn't necessarily been done to date to give you an advantageous position. You know, you offer choice, you offer advice, and you offer, I think, a differentiated service to some. So it's in my mind about how brokers package that up, how they put that proposition together. And as you know, more and more investments come in marketing for the directs, and more investment comes in technology for the directs, being able to understand what your points of differentiation are and be able to really digitize that and make that a key effective platform to work from is going to be the difference.
When you first came on, you said you expected digital to catch right away.
Mm-hmm.
So, A, why hasn't it, and what's holding it up?
You know, the UK's, last decade, to some extent, was really powered by having a big financial crisis that made it a necessity to do that as consumers look for lower costs and lower price offerings. So I think there hasn't been quite the same race to the bottom on price that there was, because there hasn't been the same kind of economic need for that. COVID may well change that. We may well start to see some quite different behaviors. I know from some of the price comparison sites I've spent some time working with and talking to in Canada in the last 6 months, you know, they are seeing year over year increases in the number of people that are shopping. So I think it's clear something's happening. The question is how fast is that going to happen? How, you know, what might a recovery look like from COVID, and where does it all bottom out?
Speaking about digital and brokers and their value props and so on, I can tell you in an earlier episode in season one, we actually delved into the sales experience that these three guys were having, you know, at a time when many carriers are doing the right thing and giving money back to their consumers because people take the cars off the road. So, you know, the whole insurance premium pie essentially was shrinking, especially with, you know, the auto side plus, you know, small businesses, you know, having less revenues and some shutting down, unfortunately, and so on. Anyway, each of these guys was growing double-digit percentage year over year. So, you know, that can only mean that more consumers are going online to shop, and these guys are positioned well, right? So,
and I think the difference between being ready when this kind of thing happens, like you guys are, right? You're in a position where you've got the platform to succeed, and the people who are now playing catch up, right?
So where's Aviva at with their investment cycle, or where are they investing in digital, and what do we expect to see in the next 12 and 18 months?
I think we've long talked about our investment in Guidewire. I think we're going to start getting some real chunky investments dropped on that in the next 12 to 18 months. I think we're going to continue to invest in the journey on APIs that we've started and hope to expand on that and do more with that, and then continue on things like paperless and some of the kind of efficiency angles that I think are just needing to be taken as we go through this COVID experience.
Any sign of how that changes the day-to-day for broker partners? Or is it yet to be seen as we
roll
out Guidewire?
I think Guidewire is going to be a quick project to deliver, right? So I think some of that will be foundational for a while before you start really feeling the impact of that. And I'm sure the guys who are working on that are thinking quite hard about the evolution of broker experience. You know, I think if we were thinking about this 12 months ago, and now you're thinking about it 12 months on with everything that's happened, what you feel you need to cater for and how you cater for the experience of brokers in that environment is going to have changed, right? So I'd say it's going to continue to evolve as the market does around us, right?
Is Guidewire a global initiative for Aviva?
I mean, Guidewire has been a global architecture standard for P&C insurance platforms for a long time, you know, probably the best part of a decade.
So they're kind of like the Applied of insurance companies.
Well,
is that fair to say?
They certainly have taken an enormous amount of market share. That's for sure. They seem, you know, everybody seems to be converging on Guidewire as a platform. That's for sure.
What sort of the minimum requirements for a broker to consider themselves truly digital?
With consumers feeling less comfortable, you know, dealing with people face to face, there aren't people necessarily walking into offices. I think there's less expectation of that being a key part of the business going forward. So I think, you know, realistically in my mind, you've got to have the ability to at least get a price in front of a customer, you know, on, you know, proper online quote with a price that they can, you know, they can stand by if they want to call you and take that up. That to me is the kind of minimum standard at this point. You know, ideally given people's expectations and the shift in consumer behaviors, you really want to be able to get to a point where you've got a website where you can do proper online sales and service, you know, whether that's, you know, necessarily every transaction someone might want to do or just the major ones. I think that's increasingly going to move to become table stakes.
They're talking about insurance getting more invisible. We're being built into the product. That's a big trend over in the UK, and they've seen it over in Asia. For instance, you buy a car, your insurance is embedded in with more makes and models, with the more technology, for example, UBI built into it. Do you think that's going to become the way things are bought, and brokers will either be part of that ecosystem, to use the term, and it's bought and we're not really front-facing? Is that a trend that you see proliferating here?
Well, look, I mean, I see it both as an ideological threat and as an opportunity for both carriers and brokers, really. You definitely can see partnerships that have evolved around, you know, vehicle manufacturers. So you can see, you know, Volvo, Porsche, people like that who do the kind of everything but the gas subscription type model where the insurance is rolled in. You definitely see those happening in the US. Whenever I've looked at those in Canada, one of the challenges has always been, certainly in Ontario, the regulatory angle on that and how you make that work. Now, you know, FSRA seem to be much more open to innovation and trying different things these days. And I would hope that that's the kind of thing that they would, you know, see as an important progressive thing to create opportunities to experiment with in the industry in Canada. But I think until there's a clear path forwards on a regulatory standpoint, it's not going to be a big breakthrough for auto, at least. You might start seeing it in the kind of warranty product type stuff. You might start seeing some of that stuff a bit more embedded in the way people buy things. But I think it'll be a while yet here. But absolutely, I think it's a huge future trend that we all need to keep an eye on and think about what our role in that ecosystem is going to be. Because, you know, if we're not thinking about it, you can guarantee that there is a whole bunch of people ranging from, you know, massively well-funded startups to enormous auto manufacturers back to a guy in his garage who's, you know, got an idea that will be thinking about it.
Independent brokers, 2,500 of us in the country, how do we view this and try to future-proof our business looking at that?
I mean, well, that's the trick, isn't it? That's the secret sauce that someone's got to crack, right? I think you can have insurance embedded with a product, but you can still be selecting covers or, you know, choosing which partner you want that through. in some way, just in the same way that when you buy, you configure what color seats you want and what color wheels you want as a new car. You know, I think there's a point where insurance could just become a couple of different drop downs in that transaction, and you're selecting some colors and different things that, you know, then brokers wow. can support choice. You know, customers said they want, you know, X, Y, and Z. That means that's going to be placed with market ABC rather than market DEF, right?
When do you think that self-driving cars arrive here? And then the follow-ups, what's the complications or impact that has for both of our businesses?
I think 5 years ago, so look, my daughter's 13, and I think about 5 years ago, I said she'd be the first generation of kids to never drive a car. And that's not going to happen. Like, you know, in 4 years time, she's going to learn to drive a car and we'll be driving a car. It's not that speed of change isn't going to happen.
She's more likely to become a hipster and get a nice manual, like cloth top something at this point.
As long as she's not, you know, finding a hipster boyfriend with a big mustache. I'm fine with that.
Except in November, apparently.
Look, I actually think Ontario in particular is very well positioned to be an extremely fast follower for autonomous vehicles. California is going to be first. I think once California crack it in terms of how they manage the challenges that come from a kind of legal perspective, a regulatory perspective, how they manage all of the things that sit around that, of which there are plenty, I think Ontario will not be that far behind, just based on the level of support we've given it as an industry so far.
Talking a decade or two decades?
I think a decade. I think a decade's not unreasonable.
10 year, and they're here in a major way. Okay, so they're here, and then the follow-up is what happens to the brokering business and what happens to the manufacturing business of the insurer rates?
I don't think anybody has got a crystal ball answer to yet, right? I think the just some of the core underlying ethical questions around autonomous vehicles. You know, you've got a elderly gentleman and a 5-year-old crossing the road, and the car computes it has to kill one of them, and it has to decide which one because it's trying to minimize casualties as it's programming. Right? How do you deal with that? Who's responsible for that?
Can you think of facial recognition deciding whether they're an Aviva client or not?
I think that might be going just a tiny bit too far, Adam.
But, futurist, yeah, but, 2 decades.
I think there is an enormous amount to be sorted out just in terms of who's accountable before you then start working out what the coverage looks like underneath that. Because I think there's an argument to be made that the OEM, the manufacturer, can be the only person who's held accountable at that point. And that radically changes the nature of the landscape for us, for sure.
If you add in transportation as a service and people buying a Netflix-like subscription to driving a car, and you can pay $200 a month to be able to drive when you need to drive or get picked up by an autonomous electric vehicle, then people think is as close as 5 years out, which I agree with you, the regulatory environment's a little tight.
No.
But it'd be interesting to
see. People like their cars, Jeff. People like their cars. I cleaned my car this afternoon. I love my car.
They like their cars, but they maybe like one car. But do you see the peak of auto insurance being hit in 2, 3, 4 years and people go down from having two cars to one car?
People will want cars for certain things. Like I know that if I'm going to drive up north and go skiing and it's an hour and a half drive and an hour and a half drive back, I will quite happily have an autonomous vehicle drive me up and drive me back. If I've got like a nice car that I enjoy driving, I'm going to go and drive it because I enjoy driving it. And that may well result in this kind of split of cover. You may have, you know, semi-autonomous vehicles where, you know, the carrier is covered when you're driving and the autonomous vehicle is covered by the manufacturer when they're driving. But I think there'll definitely be some use cases that are different, and you'll see the market segment differently as a result.
If I was to ask you honestly, where are insurers putting their money? Is it on the broker channel long term, or is it we need to cut deal with Toyota and get into the door with manufacturers? What's that space look like?
For the people who love their cars or want to drive, for example, in this future world, a broker is incredibly well positioned because they're going to want, you know, to look after their vehicle. They're going to want the best advice, and they're going to want to make sure they've got the right cover for it. For your consumer that just wants to get from A to B, I think, you know, the manufacturer underwritten future is something that I think is, you know, potentially a reality for them. But I don't think it's a single bet that the whole industry is going to go one way or the other. And, you know, as a company like Aviva, we'll need to back multiple distribution channels and multiple different ways to market to be successful.
You gotta hedge your bets.
As we do today, right?
Yep. Ben, you've bought an insurance brokerage. What do you do to fix it up?
Are you selling, Steve?
Sure, I've just sold it to you.
In my mind, it would really be about knowing what your core digital platform to grow the business is going to be, investing in that, and expecting that, you know, to see growth on that. But it's a long-term play of investment to make a return work on that, in my mind. I mean, I haven't given a lot of thought, Steve, because I'm not actually in the process of buying a brokerage.
No.
But, you know, if you're selling, let me know.
That's good. That's good. He's going to sell at 2x commissions.
2x right. Premium.
Let's keep it to the insurance world. What one problem would you fix with a magic wand?
I would probably try and get to a kind of standardized set of APIs and interchange for the industry, because I think that would just create a platform for innovation and creativity that would power the industry somewhere it's not been able to go today.
As the IBAC DX rep on the call, I hope you take that message back to your executive committee, because that's the correct answer.
I'll send them more beer.
Send beer for everybody on the executive team. Let's get outside the insurance industry for a second. What non-insurance company do you most admire, and why?
BrewDog. BrewDog are they're a brewery, they are just awesome as a business, because like they innovate everything. So they start from a position of two guys that want to start a brewery to innovate the industry by making great beer. So they start making great beer, and then they start innovating on different types of beer. And then, you know, people start to hear about their beer. They think it's cool. They start to then, you know, they innovated their ownership structure. So they, you know, people could buy shares in the company. Then they innovated how their AGMs work. So their AGM is basically like a music festival that happens once a year. It's totally different. And then they started buying pubs in the UK. So they kind of started to vertically integrate their distribution network. Wow. So they could control the experience for people and create a more meaningful brand wrap around it. I think they've twice made the most alcoholic beer the world has ever seen, and they've been beaten once in the middle, and they had to innovate the technology to be able to get enough malt in the mash to be able to create enough alcohol. So I love them as an organization, because I just think they're just so innovative.
BrewDog.com. I'm on it. It's cool.
Yeah.
All right. We will just give a quick shout out to our sponsors, to Gore and to Crew.io, who is always help us make sure we have a little bit of money left over to donate to one of the best causes in the insurance industry, to WIC. And say Ben, thank you very much for coming on the show. Great pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Great to see you. Thanks for everything.
Thank you.
All right. And Ben, we'll give you the last word here. Do you have some closing thoughts? Any thoughts for the industry, for brokers? You know, what one message do you want to shout out to the insurance world here?
I would just say that, you know, Aviva is going to be doing some pretty interesting things in the next couple of years, and I think we're a company to watch, company to work with, and we look forward to collaborating with everybody to build a better industry here in Canada.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Ben.
Well said.
Cool. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
I think he's full of shit. No, I'm kidding. Ben's a great guy. It's nice. It comes off natural. It was cool to hear him talk about a bit of the humility of saying, you know, he had that spark over there, was sent over here with a mission, or came over here on a mission of, we're on the precipice of digitizing, and they threw in a huge investment and chip stacked down, and then whether through headwinds or the industry just didn't flip to digital overnight.
Ben came over to Canada. I mean, I was there at the time. He came over as the CIO, right? So yeah. the head technologist, if you will. And he definitely came over. He'd spent some time in the garage over in the UK, the UK version of the garage, and you know, really had that digital view. And he took Aviva's technology out of the 50s, 1950s.
Yeah.
And brought it into the 21st century, right? He didn't just bring the talk, he brought the walk as well, right? A lot of basic stuff got updated. A lot of important stuff got updated. There was, you know, a lot more investments being put into it.
He kind of brought the sexy, like the sexiness back to insurance, the whole digital thing. He brought that vibe over.
He's the Timberlake. Because,
I'm not saying sex. I'm just saying the sexiness factor of insurance. Like, there's no other space in 2016 when it opened up like the digital garage in insurance across Canada. You know, you walked in there, Lady Lovelace is on the wall. Steve Jobs is on there. Yeah. The space is perfectly designed from head to toe. It was like you're working at a startup, and it was like you're working at Google in insurance. So I got to think it attracted a lot of really cool people into the industry. Yeah. It helped them land some good talent. You know, they got off the front and the gate really quickly, like Aviva always does, and then had to backtrack. They got ahead of digital further than anybody else. And then the wheels kind of fell off because of the market. And they had to make a shift in the pivot. Ben pivoted with it. He's still in Canada. He's still working at Aviva. So he's done the ultimate pivot, and he's coming back to the whole maturity of digital, right?
What I think one of the outcomes, if you will, of the garage, forget all the digital stuff, is just that driving home the fact that the environment in which you work has a positive or negative impact on how people think. And you know, you guys have been to the office they have in Markham, right? It is night and day difference from the office in Scarborough. And you could see how people thought and operated and interacted with each other when they were at the garage versus when they were at, you know, the traditional kind of beige wall kind of place, yeah. Right? Totally different thought process, way more creative.
I wouldn't know Ben if I wasn't on the CSIO board with him for, I don't know, he was there for 5 meetings maybe. Yeah, he lobbed grenades for thought. And then he just disappeared. But some of the stuff that we're still doing today and talking about is because he pushed.
He asked questions 5 years ago. How much would you pay to hear him sing Alanis Morissette in karaoke? What do you think of the idea that this podcast wouldn't exist without Aviva?
No, it wouldn't.
You got to follow back a few butterfly effects, but like, yeah, we all know Tom. Because Tom and Aviva created the Digital Broker Council.
Tom picked us.
we got together over a lot of years and, you know, made a bond. They had the courage to invest in it. They had the courage to go and lead and do something different. They had the courage to get this ridiculously overpriced Bay Street address, build it out with shipping containers and make it cool. That, to the point, we all know the art on the wall. You name me another piece of art in another insurance company office anywhere. You can't.
That's true. That's
it
true.
Means something. Yeah. And as a guy who's failed at a lot of shit and lost a lot of money, like, I can respect that, you know, they're going to dust themselves off and walk into that board meeting and throw grenades and see, like, this is horseshit. Forget all your pomp and, like, practice. Like, I'm not doing it. Like, but why? Why are we here? For these tea and crumpets? Like, forget it.
Digital maturity. When was digital maturity going to hit?
And I think we just got the last word on this wrap.
Tom's getting called for dinner, Tom.
Right. No. Yeah. I just think, how can we top what Adam just said? It's impossible.